rum, Cabernet, Dumonet. They're here to slay the art history babes.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Corey.
I'm Natalie.
And I'm Jen. And we are the art history babes.
Today, we're talking about our girl, Yoko Ono.
Oh, Yoko. We just love her.
We love her so much. Most of you probably know her as the chick who, quote unquote, broke up the Beatles.
Boo.
Which is not the case. She's way more fascinating and way more complex and way more amazing than all that. And we're here to tell you
about her and her life that she did have before she met John Lennon.
A very, fulfilling and interesting and crazy life.
Mm-hmm.
That just got more crazy thanks to your boy Lennon.
So before we dive headfirst into that, anything new?
I just got back from a trip up north again, but before that, I was in Southern California and I had a chance to stop by LACMA for the first time. Which was really fun. And I saw a Robert Mapplethorpe exhibit, which was really great. I saw Agnes Martin, who is a phenomenal abstract expressionist, minimalist artist. Yeah, and they have a great collection there, so glad I got to finally see it. Corey was there not that long ago, and she got to see something I didn't.
I feel like you and I had two totally different LACMA experiences.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You saw the stuff some of the stuff I wanted to see and did get a chance to see, and vice versa.
And then neither of us got to see the Rain Room.
Oh, the Rain Room. It's sold out for, ever and
I
ever.
I know.
For, all of eternity.
Yeah.
I want to go so bad.
So, guys, the Rain Room is, you walk through this room where it's kind of like just a downpour everywhere, and there's motion sensors, so wherever a person steps, it stops raining in that spot, and so it's one person at a time. It sounds really, really fucking cool, and I'm really sad.
And they, when Prince died, they turned it purple.
Oh my god!
I know. How cool is that?
That's so
the coolest
good.
Thing. LACMA killing
I've
it.
I've ever heard.
I know, right?
Literally.
And
ever.
The timing, to have that open.
I know.
Wow. That's pretty badass.
Oh, well, keep up the great work, LACMA.
We should all hit up LACMA when we're in LA for the podcast festival.
Oh, folks.
Podcast festival.
We're going to a podcast festival, and we're pretty much just going to learn how to
do this.
because we know some things.
We're learning every day.
So, you guys that listen, you're just the best. And we really love you, and keep listening. I think it's just going to get better. And yeah, we're going to go learn.
Also, just a heads up, we are diving into the world of YouTube videos.
Oh.
So, you can get all of our podcasts on YouTube, just if you want to listen to them with some images. But also, I think tomorrow, Nat and I are going to actually record ourselves talking about art on a video.
You can see our faces.
You can see our faces. We're going to talk about modernism. So yeah, be on the lookout for that as well. Follow us on YouTube. So, Yoko Ono. Here we go. We're doing this. So, Yoko Ono was born in Tokyo, Japan in 1933. She kind of went back and forth between Japan and the United States because her father, I believe, was a businessman.
Yeah. Her dad was a banker, and so when World War II broke out, his first sort of order of business was, I gotta get my family the hell out of here.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot of going back and forth, a lot of trying to resituate the family, first in San Francisco, then in New York, and then they ended up coming back. And there was a period of time where Yoko doesn't remember where her dad was. They thought he was in a prisoner of war camp in Vietnam. And he was not, apparently. Apparently he was still in the United States, and they just didn't know. So, yeah, and then there was a period of time where Yoko Ono came from a family that was well off.
Mm-hmm.
very like well off.
Japanese aristocrats.
Yes. Yeah. Not royalty, but pretty much like very, very well off family. And then they became entirely destitute during the war and had to barter their goods for food and had to basically care for themselves. And Yoko Ono has told many of these stories during interviews. There's evidence of her family having gone hungry. Things like that were very important and formed her, what she calls her aggressive personality. So
I heard an interview where she talks a lot about how her mom wanted to raise her to be like a very independent woman too, even despite their family starting out with starting out wealthy before World War II. But her mom still saw the value in teaching her to be a strong and independent, not to use a cliche, but woman. And yeah, I think you can see that in the way that a lot of people try to perceive her as cold. And it's not, in fact, like that. And I think people are starting to accept her more now that she's, like, 80. And it's been a long time since the Beatles broke up.
She's paid her dues.
Yeah.
Speaking of the Beatles breaking up, we'll just kind of dive into that quick. So, as we mentioned, you might be the most familiar with Yoko Ono as the wife of John Lennon, and this has been a very important kind of factor in just the defining of Yoko Ono, the image of her in the public eye, but she's so much more than all of that. She's an incredibly influential and talented artist as well, and a lot of people, unfortunately, just don't know about her work. So Yoko Ono and John Lennon, a little bit of just history on their relationship. They met November 9th, 1966 at the Indica Gallery in London at one of Yoko Ono's shows. And there's a kind of a few versions of the story where when they first met. But it was Yoko Ono had this show at this somewhat avant-garde gallery.
It was happening.
It was, yeah. John Lennon was doing like a private viewing. Neither one of them really knew who the other was. Like Yoko Ono didn't really know who John Lennon was, and John Lennon didn't know who Yoko Ono was. But he was doing a private viewing like right before it opened. And a lot of Yoko's work is incredibly conceptual. And John Lennon didn't have the best opinion of conceptual art. He found a lot of it to be kind of negative or like nihilistic. But as the story goes, a few different things happened. Apparently, he went to this exhibit. He saw there was one piece that was a apple on a pedestal, and it was selling for, what was it, 200 quid?
No idea how much money that is.
I don't know either.
We didn't look it up.
Yeah,
we're just going to
come
out. But
too much for an apple.
It was an apple.
And so, like, apparently John Lennon both was frustrated by this, but also thought it was really funny. Like, he appreciated the kind of humor in Ono's work. And then there was another piece where there's, like, a ladder that you climb. And he climbed up the ladder, and once you get to the top, he saw the word yes, and this kind of was apparently a big moment for John Lennon because he had this opinion of, like, conceptual art being so negative, and it really, what was his exact words? It was nice to see.
He was very relieved that it was positive and that it didn't say, like, no or fuck you, to use his words, and so the fact that it was affirmative message made him want to stay and made him want to see the rest of the show. And, you know, he did some clever John Lennon stuff. Like, you know, there was, where was the,
it was
the nails? There was something for him to.
Yeah, it was nails that it was supposed to be for, like, the audience.
Hammer in a nail.
Yeah, to hammer in a nail.
And I think it was called Hammer Piece.
Probably.
And you had to pay a certain amount of money to hammer in a nail. And so he didn't want to pay the money. So he said, well, how about I give you imaginary money and
I think
hammer in an imaginary nail.
I think what happened was it didn't cost money to hammer in the nail, but he wanted to do it before the show opened.
And she wanted it to stay pristine for the opening.
Yes. She wanted it to stay pristine for the audience, and then and he wanted a hammer and a nail, and she asked him for money to do it.
Oh,
and
right.
Then he goes, I will give you an imaginary $5 if I can hammer in an imaginary nail.
Right. So basically, John Lennon shows up to the Indica Gallery to fluster Yoko Ono, who is like, who is this man? And Yoko claims, and I believe her, that she had no conception of who the Beatles even were.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That she didn't know how famous they were. She just, you know, met this guy. And context, she's 8 years older than him. She has been running in avant-garde circles since the 1950s.
And is very well known within them.
And here's this rock star who she doesn't really care very much about in her gallery. And it really just, they both kind of caught each other by surprise, it sounds like. And
I mean, all of these little anecdotes are so ridiculously like avant-garde. It's silly, but
right.
But the best one, and this one I heard from, it's in an interview with Yoko herself, and I think I read it as a quote from, I read it in a quote from John Lennon as well, was the actual moment when they met in this gallery space. So obviously it was a private encounter, so they were probably interacting a lot, but the moment when they like actually met, apparently the owner of the gallery was trying to get Yoko Ono to go talk to John Lennon because he's this millionaire rock star. And so Yoko Ono goes up to John Lennon and she hands him a card and it just says breathe on it. And apparently he looked at it and then he looked at her and then he just took this big like panting breath. And that was their first interaction, which is like ridiculous, but romantic, but perfect, like mm-hmm. all in.
It would be unrealistic for any other couple.
Yeah,
but, like,
but it works.
But
for
you
them.
Believe it.
Well,
for them.
Yeah. And then what happened then? So then what happened was that. So this is what happened. I was one of those kids who was like way obsessed with the Beatles when I was in like middle school, so I just like learned everything about them, and now I have all this knowledge. For some reason, I knew this day would come.
For this moment,
I knew this day would come. well, okay, so both John Lennon and Yoko Ono were married, and they were both in very unhappy marriages. And John Lennon was actually kind of an asshole; like he was a abusive husband and didn't treat his wife very well. And Yoko Ono was married to one Tony Cox, who abducted their daughter and moved to New Zealand, and just Yoko spent years and years and years trying to reconnect with her daughter and locate her. And so that's all happening in the background, and they meet each other, and then they just, you know, it's like a 2-year thing where they start just getting to know each other, and wouldn't you know it, John Lennon's really interested in this super eccentric, different type of woman, not the kind of woman that a Beatle would be meeting very often. Also, 1966, that was around the time the Beatles stopped touring and decided to just start taking copious amounts of LSD.
For real.
A lot of LSD. And John Lennon in particular was an LSD champion.
Yeah, there were people that were like legitimately concerned he was going to fry his brain.
He took it every single day for a number
of
for some years. Yeah. That's a lot of acid. So it's not too far-fetched to assume that he became super interested in everything that was going on in the avant-garde. He also went to an art college when he was still in Liverpool. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, why they ended up together. And the whole idea that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles is just so stupid. Because, you know, you need to really understand, like, the Beatles were these four guys that started hanging out when they were teenagers. And then they got super famous. And then they spent the majority of, like, 5 or 6 years confined to hotel rooms because they were constantly on tour or recording or couldn't go out onto the street because they would get mauled by young women. So I think that the Beatles were sick and tired of each other.
For real. Yeah.
And after 10 years of being stuck with these other people who, you know what, even if you're with your best friend and you love your best friend and you're in the same room with them for 10 years, you're not gonna want to see them. Like, mm-hmm. you're just gonna get so sick of them.
Yeah, I mean, just that level of just, yeah, being together all the time is just not sustainable. Like, it was never sustainable.
The Beatles grew up. And they broke up themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, the idea that Yoko Ono broke up the Beatles is just stupid. So stop saying it.
Stop. For real.
Just stop it.
If you keep saying that after this podcast, then don't ever talk to me again. Because
don't ever talk to me or my son ever again.
Because that is just asinine. And I refuse to hear it again. So it's done. And that's it. We said it right now.
Okay, we said it right now.
Okay, now.
Anyways, okay, last little bit on John Lennon and Yoko Ono. They did a very important performance piece together, which they did a series of bed-ins, also referred to as bed piece. Piece spelled P-E-A-C-E in 1969, and it was technically, the first one was technically their honeymoon. It was right after they got married.
Was that the one in Toronto?
No, Amsterdam. That was Amsterdam.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So they did two week-long bed-ins for peace as a protest against the Vietnam War. There was one, the first one was at the Hilton in Amsterdam, and then there was one that they did in Montreal. You can watch the film.
Oh, Montreal.
Montreal. You can watch the film of Bed Peace in Montreal on YouTube. The whole thing's there. I would recommend it. It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The second, interesting little tidbit, the second one, the Bed Peace in Montreal, was actually supposed to be in New York. But John was not allowed in the U.S. at this time because of a weed conviction in 1968. So they went to Montreal instead.
Oh, that kooky beetle.
That kooky beetle and his marijuana.
With his wacky tobacco.
But anyway, so they did this sit-in protest in which they stayed in this in a bed in a hotel room, and it was kind of a like a doors open, letting people come in, letting a film crew come in, letting different journalists come in. There are scenes in which it's kind of just like they invited their friends over, like Timothy Leary was there,
yeah.
Allen Ginsberg was there, so like
Tim Leary, he was just there dropping off some stuff.
it was a fun group of people. They made art in bed. They
they recorded "Give Peace a Chance."
Yes,
in bed.
Yes, they recorded music. They had when they had other people over, they would just kind of do, you know, essentially your stereotypical like hippie hangout vibes, like playing music. Sending out good vibes, out love, and it was all in protest of the war.
And well, first of all, that the fact that Yoko is a musician in her own right, that people probably don't know that.
Oh yeah, did we mention that? I don't think we mentioned.
I don't think
that.
We mentioned all of her many titles.
Yeah,
many.
Yoko Ono was
she's a Renaissance woman.
She's a classically trained pianist. Her father was a concert pianist. Mm-hmm. And she was trained in classical piano from the age of 4 and studied at one of the most prestigious schools in Japan alongside Prince Akihata or something. I'm sorry. the prince, okay?
Not to be confused with Prince.
It was the Prince of Japan. I don't have the name. I'm sorry. So she was very talented. I would also like to point out that the bed-ins for peace were basically they were treated as these sort of like big publicity stunts.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And but it's important to note that these were still conceptual pieces that they did. You know, it wasn't just a publicity stunt, but they both were aware of how they were being perceived in the public eye. And I think that when you are in the public eye as a celebrity, you should use your celebrity for whatever. And what better than peace? So,
and they took control of the media hounding them because it was going to happen either way. So they decided to harness it and use it for a greater good. Definitely. Rather than just letting it be about their lives, they turned it into a global, they turned it into drawing attention to a global issue and trying to make a change. Yoko, though, I heard her talk in an interview, speak in an interview recently where she kind of says that looking back, she feels like it was a little bit silly that they thought that people would be that right. interested in them, but
they were.
Yeah. But they were, yeah.
Like, they people, well, you know what? People thought they were going to go into that hotel room and they were going to be, like, having sex.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's been report, people thought, like, this is going to be a sex thing.
Yeah.
And it wasn't a sex thing. If there was anything insidious behind it, not that sex is insidious.
I mean, there was definitely, I know in the piece, there was a sexual element to it, but more in, like, the love sense. Like, mm-hmm. they were trying to spread, yeah. Like, the idea that, like, sex is an expression of love. Yeah, you didn't walk into the room and see them having sex. Like, that wasn't the idea. But they were kind of pushing this platform that, like, we should all be hanging out and playing music and making art and having sex, making love, like, all positive things.
Yeah. It also... And this is not to speak negatively on either John or Yoko, but they both had kind of a nasty heroin problem at the time.
I didn't know that.
They did. They both were really hooked on heroin, and they went clean in the early 70s, and that was like a really... They started eating this like... macrobiotic diet or something.
She claims they never injected. Too,
right. Yeah. Which they didn't. And
yeah,
I
they both had a fear of needles, yes. which she thinks saved them.
Yeah.
Ultimately.
Yeah. And so they were hooked on heroin. And I think that if you're hooked on heroin, sitting in bed for 2 weeks is not that hard. So, you know, I'm sorry. That sounds so mean, but yeah, I feel like we should put that out there that was yeah. also a factor.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So yeah, that's bed piece, or also known as the bed ins. Let's kind of move away from Mr. Lennon.
Yes.
Into Yoko Ono's work. Let's start with her, I think, biggest work or most well-known work, which is 1964's Cut Piece. Cut Piece, if you are not familiar with it, is one of the most important performance works to ever have happened. It essentially, once again, you can watch excerpts of it on YouTube, but it essentially consists of Yoko Ono sitting in a room and allowing the audience to cut away at her clothes with scissors. Totally, like, unscripted, just her sitting there and letting the artwork develop as it will. So kind of you have this shift of audience member to artist.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's been done more and more over time, but this was 1964. This was kind of...
Cutting edge.
Yeah, this was super cutting edge. This was one of the first times this kind of thing happened.
So,
cutting edge.
Got it?
So taking the audience members who are generally in art, the passive member of the interaction, you know, they're looking at the art, and making them active in letting the artist become the passive one sitting there and basically being at the mercy of these viewers who are literally cutting away pieces of her clothing. And not only that, but it's kind of touching on this, like, violence. I mean, there's kind of an inherent violence to do with scissors and cutting and stripping someone down and exposing her. So then you get this violence kind of juxtaposed with this vulnerability that she's offering up. There's a lot of layers going on.
For real. It says interesting things about voyeurism, too. Because mm-hmm. Typically, like, looking at art is such a voyeuristic act. But now you're becoming active in the artwork, but you're still a voyeur.
Yeah, because while one person, there's one pair of scissors. So the scissors is, she's up there fully clothed with the scissors next to her. And then the participants start coming up one at a time. So while that one person's up there, there's still the rest of the audience kind of watching them. So it's this really interesting kind of exchange that starts happening.
Yeah. Cut Piece was performed at least on six different occasions by Yoko Ono. It's been performed by other people as well. Yoko Ono was active not necessarily a part of, but was active within a group which became known as Fluxus. Now, Fluxus was a group that was operating throughout the 1960s and really got its start through a series of concerts that took place at Yoko Ono's Chamber Street loft in New York City. So Yoko Ono lived in New York City, and she met John Cage, who is a experimental composer, artist, and also Lamont Young. So these were composers, and these people were not, they didn't confine themselves to one medium. So they composed music, but they saw their work as essentially a like multimedia style. They were multimedia artists, if we want to simplify it. So they believed in like total art. So something that really arrests the senses. Yoko Ono met John Cage actually at a lecture at a university in New York City. And then they became good friends, and they started this series of concerts at Yoko's apartment. And these concerts became the seminal events that launched the Fluxus group, which Fluxus referring to something that's constantly in flux, constantly changing. So that's a little bit of background. And the thing about Fluxus that's interesting is that it really embraced this idea of chance. So anyway, they hosted these events. They called them happenings because it's the 1960s, baby, and stuff is happening. And so it's within this environment that Yoko Ono started making these pieces, as most of her work is referred to. And the great thing about these Fluxus events is that they tended to focus on these sort of like single gesture actions. So in the case of cut piece, the gesture is to come up on stage and cut off a piece of Yoko's clothing and take it with you. And so because of this, many are easily expressed as written performance instructions. Mm-hmm. So that's how cut piece exists. It's cut piece is an instructional piece.
And I don't know which cut piece she decided to kind of change it a little bit, but later on in performing it, she did the thing where she asked people to cut a piece no smaller than no bigger than a post-it note, right?
Really?
Does anyone remember this? And then she asked them to send it to someone they love.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
That was like a later kind of addition.
That's cool.
Or a later change that she made to the performance. But it's like, it's a really sweet sentiment.
That's
and it's
interesting.
Turning it into like kind of a gifting instruction.
Yeah, I would love to send a piece of Yoko Ono's clothing to someone I love.
Right?
Like, that'd be the best love letter ever.
Or to receive a piece of Yoko's clothing from someone who loves you.
Like, I would freak out.
If you're trying to win my heart, send me a piece of Yoko Ono's clothing.
Well, and you know, that's great because it really that touches on something that I read. So Yoko really considered this piece to be like a sacrifice, like a gift that mm-hmm. she was giving to the audience. That's how she thinks of this work.
Well, it definitely is. Like allowing, I mean, for any human to allow people to, I don't know, it's kind of, it's a penetrating act in like a lot of ways. And to allow like other human beings to kind of penetrate into your space like that and to act in that way, I feel like that's a gift to give to someone.
Yeah, and when she would go on stage, she would wear like her best outfit. Like she would go up there dressed to the nines, and she would sit in a traditional, like, Japanese woman's seated position.
Yeah, I think it's like a yoga position of
some
sort.
It's called,
probably didn't originate as a yoga position, but I think it is.
There's a...
Is it called the Yoko Ono?
No, there's a traditional name to the way that she's sitting, but the point of it is that it's a very like ritualistic act, and her going up there and giving this sort of like gift to the audience, which is cutting off her piece of her clothing, is it's like what she chooses to give the audience. And something that needs to be mentioned is that the world of the Fluxus avant-garde was by no means a equal playing ground for men and women. There were several Fluxus artists and many women, and the women were essentially expected to like play ball in a man's court, you know, and it wasn't really a feminist-friendly space. Most of the avant-garde after World War II was in some ways shifted towards a more global perspective, but even then it was still heavily informed by Western patriarchal society.
Patriarchy.
Ugh.
Oh, the patriarchy.
You know, and you can't escape it. I mean, it's just everywhere, and it especially was around this time, which is the, you know, mid to late 1960s. Many what you would consider like proto-feminist movements and thoughts were sort of circulating, and many want to brand Yoko Ono and especially Cut Piece as a proto-feminist work, and they want to brand Yoko Ono as a feminist, which is fine, considering, you know, this work was performed by a woman of color who historically gets the worst part of society.
Yeah, I was just telling you this. I actually, in this documentary I watched called The Real Yoko Ono, made in 2001. It's actually, I mean...
I've seen that.
Yoko Ono's in it, so that makes it pretty good. But it's actually more of a documentary about Yoko and John Lennon, to be honest. It's not really that much about like Yoko Ono's work or anything. And they interview Yoko Ono and John Lennon's son, Sean Lennon, and he has a quote where he's talking about how he doesn't think that Yoko Ono would have gotten like the backlash that she did had she been a blonde woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's like probably 100% on point, unfortunately.
Yeah, you can't deny the racism in effect when it comes to people hating on Yoko.
Like, yeah, especially if you look at like contemporary media coverage on the breaking up of the Beatles and of John's divorce and the very public sort of courtship of John and Yoko. Most of the media coverage is painfully racist. It's, they called her the Dragon Lady.
Mm-hmm.
They called her like yellow, just like horrible things to say, and you know, they called her just flat out ugly, which is, who says that? That's so,
it is just not, it's even not remotely
even,
true.
It's not even true.
Yeah. Like, she's a very beautiful woman.
If I could look like Yoko Ono, if I live to be 83 years old and I can look like Yoko Ono, I would just be ecstatic. In 1973 or 4, mid-70s, John and Yoko split up. She just was, like, tired of him. Honestly, that's really what happened. She was exhausted. The whole media, constant barrage of media coverage and paparazzi and their anti-war movement and concerts. She was just exhausted. And honestly, John Lennon was obsessed with her. He was obsessed with her. He wouldn't even let her go to the bathroom by herself. Like, he was very, he had some attachment issues with her. She represented something for him that goes beyond the typical romantic relationship.
She's the original manic pixie dream girl.
Yeah. She ended up sending him away. Just said, you know what? Just go take our assistant and get out of here. And so he did. And he had what he referred to as his long weekend. And he was gone for 18 months.
That's what he called it?
He called it the long weekend. Or no, the lost weekend. I'm sorry. The lost weekend. Mm-hmm. Where he just partied. He partied for like a year and a half. And he
was with another woman that like Yoko set him up
with. That was the assistant.
Yeah.
one May Pang.
Yes.
And, you know, so she, you know, the point is that she had no trouble with men. And I really hate this idea that she was like this, I don't know, that she was somehow chasing after John Lennon, like the ultimate groupie. And that's just so wrong.
On that note, I think we should take a quick break.
Here to slay the art history babes.
And we're back, and we switched out Ginny for Natalie.
No, Natalie for Ginny.
Did we?
Hey, it's me, it's Nat. No, I'm just kidding, it's Ginny.
So Ginny's here, to clarify.
Oh my goodness.
We're the same person.
Did you ever notice how the two of them were never in a room at the same time?
I know.
Oh, man. Anyways, we're talking about Yoko Ono. We just kind of finished up on Cut Piece, her kind of most seminal work. And now we're going to talk about some of her other work, some of the other stuff she was into. So,
yeah, Yoko Ono, after the Beatles broke up, after a period of, you know, relative domestic bliss with John Lennon, you know, they took a big break out of their career, and during that time, Yoko got really involved in just kind of managing John's career, and she really put her own career on the back burner. And around that time, she also ended up getting into the occult. It's interesting for us because we're very fascinated by these kinds of sort of esoteric themes and topics, and
we like witchy shit.
We do. We really do. And you know, Yoko Ono is still a big proponent of of numerology and you know, tarot readings. And
I'm getting my tarot cards right on set tomorrow.
Oh, that's so exciting.
Lucky.
I get my tarot cards read.
You know, I love that kind of shit. It's really great. And so, you know, that actually is interesting because it's kind of like one more thing that puts Yoko Ono in this strange sort of position where she becomes even more polarizing of a figure. You know, some people have cited her sort of like occult leanings as more reason to
be afraid of her.
Yeah, people are afraid of Yoko Ono. It's interesting. And what I love is that sometime around 2007, Yoko Ono released an album called Yes, I'm a Witch. And the album is a remix album that is inspired by a 1974 song that she featured on one of her own albums called A Story. And the song is called Yes, I'm a Witch. Yoko Ono did very much enjoy recording music, and she still does, actually. And so we really enjoy that she kind of has these little witchy leanings, you know, mm-hmm. because where we often talk about our little group here as a coven of sorts. And Yoko, you are in our coven.
Honorary coven member. Yeah,
I really love it.
Yeah. Yeah. So some of her other notable works. In 1964, she published Grapefruit, which was kind of a conceptual art piece, and it was also a book. This term grapefruit was actually used in a lot of her work. It first appeared when she wrote a story for the newspaper while she was at Sarah Lawrence College entitled Grapefruit in a World of Park. And in this story, the grapefruit, it kind of serves as a metaphor for her own hybridity, her own cultural hybridity. So grapefruit has just been a very important word, symbol to her. In Grapefruit, published in 1964, it consisted of a series of these instruction pieces, which, as we mentioned before, a lot of her work is very instructional. It allows the audience a chance to kind of become the artist as well. Just a couple of them. Let's see. One of them says, "Let people copy or photograph your paintings. Destroy the originals." My favorite one is entitled "Tuna Fish Sandwich Piece." And it says, "Imagine 1,000 suns in the sky at the same time. Let them shine for 1 hour. Then let them gradually melt into the sky. Make one tuna fish sandwich and eat." Spring of 1964. So yeah, that one's, I know, it's personally, it's my favorite just because the, like, the grand scale of the imagery and how, like, existential and intense this idea of, like suns melting into the sky, and then it just, like, ends on something so mundane as making a tuna fish sandwich.
Can I read one? I have a little baby one that I really enjoy. From the spring of 1960, it's titled "Blood Peace." "Use your blood to paint. Keep painting until you faint. Keep painting until you die." I like it, you know?
That's intense right there.
It's a good one.
It is. I dig it for sure.
It's just, check out Grapefruit. It's full of this amazing little stuff. It'll just make you think.
For sure. If nothing else, it'll, I don't know, if you follow Yoko Ono's, and like if you're bored one day, just, like, pull out one of Yoko Ono's instructional pieces. I'm sure it'll lead to interesting activities. Another one of her works, she got into experimental film in the 60s. One of these films was entitled Four, also known as Number Four, also known as Bottoms. And it is essentially just a video of a series of butts walking on a treadmill, like close-ups of different people's butts as they walk on this treadmill. And you said you saw that, didn't you?
Yeah, Sam? I saw that at the MoMA in New York City last year. So they had an entire show dedicated to Yoko Ono. It was Yoko Ono, a one-woman show. And so there was a corner of the gallery consisted of just a big blank wall where a projector was running. And it was just literally, it was bottoms. And they were walking on a treadmill. And God damn, it was just fascinating. You just
cut, kind of meditative.
You just stare. It was, you know, it was very interesting. And I really enjoyed this sort of like meditating on like the mechanics of the human body.
Yeah, for real. So Yoko Ono has worked on these wish trees that started in kind of the late 80s, early 90s, and it's been an ongoing project ever since. They have gone up all around the world. It's essentially you write wishes on cards and tie them to trees. The exact instructions written by Yoko Ono are, "Make a wish, write it down on a piece of paper, fold it and tie it around a branch of a wish tree. Ask your friends to do the same. Keep wishing until the branches are covered with wishes." Which is just lovely.
That is lovely. And I think we were talking to Natalie about this, but there's supposedly this is taken from like a practice from Japanese, like Buddhist temples where you go there and you meditate on your sort of like hopes and dreams and you leave a little written wish on this wherever on the temple. I'm not sure what they use. It could be a tree, it could be like a bell that they ring. But it's interesting because I feel like a lot of what Yoko ends up doing sort of draws from these like Zen Buddhist principles.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Those are just a few of her really important work. Shifting into more of Yoko Ono in the contemporary world, I mentioned this before, but there is this T-shirt that Zara made that was a Yoko Ono quote, and I think it was a couple years ago, and it was like super expensive because it's Zara, but and I want it so bad, but I can only find knockoffs, but right. I'm still probably gonna buy it anyways.
It's literally a shirt,
a T-shirt.
It's a T-shirt.
It's a white T-shirt, and in like little tiny letters, like right in the center, it says, this Yoko Ono quote, it says, "Art is a way of survival, Yoko Ono," which is like one of my favorite quotes. I think it's so perfect and something I want to wear around on my body all the time. She also has her Twitter is fire. Her Twitter is so great. Her Twitter handle is at Yoko Ono. If you follow us on Twitter, I retweet her all the time. They're just like, she just like tweets out these really inspirational, wonderful tweets like fairly regularly. I pulled a couple of them out. Let's see, one of them, "You don't have to take care of other people's feelings, just know your feelings. Though that too is not easy." And it's just like, how so wise.
So true.
So true, yeah.
So wise, so true.
Then another one, "Become an oasis, rejuvenate and revitalize, heal the world."
I would love to be an oasis.
Right? You are an oasis.
You're
stop it.
My oasis.
Like the band?
No.
Anyway, here's Wonderwall.
Don't look back in anger. I mean, you just said.
Oh my god. Ginny, do you want to talk about her most recent work?
Yeah. So, Yoko Ono, still very active, and after the shootings in Dallas, obviously, tensions have been high in the United States, and the Dallas Museum of Art, the senior curator of contemporary art, asked Yoko Ono if she would make some kind of piece to kind of promote this sense of peace and hope after everything that happened in Dallas a few weeks back. And so she agreed, and what she made is kind of this large banner. It's a white backdrop and black text, and it says, "Imagine peace forever," and says it on the opposite end in Spanish. So this comes from John Lennon's song, Imagine, and then she just adds on, "Imagine peace forever." And this is her most recent work as of a few weeks ago. And if you are in Dallas, you should check it out because it looks pretty incredible. And yeah, that's the most recent Yoko update.
Yeah. So I think that kind of wraps things up on our episode about the great Yoko Ono. We're gonna end our episode with some listener mail. All right, what do we got, Ginny?
Okay. So this comes from Claire. Art history, babes. I only stumbled upon the podcast a couple of days ago, but I am now a huge fan. I just graduated with a double major in art history and Italian, and I'm headed to grad school this far. I'm sorry, I'm mispronouncing everything tonight. This fall. Your podcast encompasses some of my favorite things about art history. You make it interesting, not stuffy, relatable, and relevant.
Aww.
You often use a feminist lens, and you guys also just seem like a ton of fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Claire. It's so nice.
Oh, Claire, you know what? We are a ton of fun, so I would love to hang out one day.
Yeah, come have fun with us whenever you want. Hit us up. We'd love to have you on our show.
Come to Cali, baby.
Oh, God. And Claire wraps up by saying that if we have any advice on the first year of grad school, even if it's just a couple of tips, she would love to hear. And keep up the good work. You guys are so awesome. Best of luck, Claire.
Claire, you're so awesome.
Yeah,
so sweet. Awesome.
Good.
So, grad school advice. I would say the best advice that I could give you would be to really make sure you're taking care of yourself, obviously. Make sure, I would suggest just making sure that you find a good support group, whether it's in your program or outside of your program, just
try and find people that, you know, those people that you can go get drinks with, you can let off steam with, you just have as your support system, you know, when things get tough. The four of us got super lucky in finding each other, like, yeah. right off the bat. 2 weeks in, and we were just like, wow, we are going to be best friends.
Yeah, I remember Corey and I made eye contact at the orientation.
This sounds romantic.
It kind of was. And I just saw her, and I was like, you, we're going to be friends. And then we met everybody else, and everyone was just so cool. And that's amazing. I think that we got crazy lucky.
We did, because I know I hear a lot of stories. I think we all hear a lot of stories about how isolating grad school can be for a lot of people. And so I think it's important to be proactive in some way and make sure you're not isolating yourself. Like I said, it might be in your program. It might be outside of your program. Just find that support system that's going to, like, be there for you. And, yeah, and I would also suggest don't sweat the small stuff. Really, don't sweat the big stuff either. Like, when things get really tough, like, you can do it. It's going to be fine. I promise it's going to be fine.
Yeah, that's kind of our mantra at the end of the quarter. Yeah, we're seriously. Just like, I don't know how I'm going to get all of this done. And it's like, I'm like on page 5 of a 25-page paper, and I just don't know how it's going to get done. And we're like, you know.
You'll get it done.
And I'm usually crying. Won't. Everything's falling apart, and you know, Ginny and Natalie and Corey are like, girl, it's going to get done. You're going to do it. And we tell that to each other. And
all
it
the
gets,
time.
And it gets done.
It all gets done.
We always finish, and it's always really good.
Yeah. And everything, like, is fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let me think. A big piece of advice, don't get wrapped up in getting competitive.
Yeah.
That is so stupid. It's just, it is not worth it.
Yeah.
There's no real reason to ever do that.
Purpose.
It serves no purpose. You're honestly, if you start to get competitive with someone, let's say that somebody is doing
exactly
what you're doing, right? And you're like, what the hell? You know, make it like a collaborative effort, like, be friends, you know, share resources. And I know that this really goes against, like, what we're taught. I think that like a capitalist society, we're kind of taught to, like,
fucking capitalism,
fend for ourselves.
God damn it.
You know, and honestly, I had a conversation with one of our professors who said, like, you know, it's really amazing to see how great all of you get along, because that's not what it was like when I was in grad school.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really sad, and I really hope that your experience is not that way. Don't get caught up in being competitive. You just work on your shit and be a friend.
And when you don't get caught up in being competitive, sometimes you do really cool things, like create a podcast with your cohort. So it's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and what else?
Oh, you got anything, Jen?
Yeah.
You know, just do your best and don't sweat the rest. Just honestly do what you can do and maintain your health, both, like, physical and mental, and make sure that you make time for having fun and doing things that are kind of removed from the world of academia, because I think it's good to kind of maintain that balance. And basically just do what you gotta do, get that degree, and, like, move on to the next thing, pretty much.
Yeah, make a lot of important contacts. You know, meet your professors, pick their brains. That's what they're there for, honestly.
Also, just going in, I mean, I don't know, like, where you're going to school, but going into an art history program, one thing that's been really cool for us is we clicked with the art MFAs. So, like, try and get in there.
Oh, my God, they're so fun.
Just try and get in there and meet the artists that are, like, at your school. Like, that's a really just cool connection to make. Not only are they great, interesting people, but we get to, like, bounce ideas off of each other. It's just, like,
totally.
A great
camaraderie.
And they
know how to party.
They think we're bookish nerds.
Little did they know. But yeah, so you know what, Claire, you're going to learn about so much of this shit when you get to grad school, and the best thing you can do is just show up there with an open mind and just do your best and don't act weird and get competitive and just make a lot of friends. And, yeah. and you know, it's going to be great. And yeah. congratulations
yes.
for getting into grad school. That's amazing. And it's a huge accomplishment. And yeah. you should feel
be
very
proud.
Proud and you should feel very excited.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You're going to do great.
So, yeah, thanks, Claire. You're awesome. Thank you all for listening so much.
Wait,
you're all awesome.
Can I say something? Can I say something?
Sure.
You know, the only reason why I'm saying this is because I've noticed that there were some haters. There were some haters on the Facebook page. And I know. I'm not going to say anything rude. No, I'm not going to say anything rude. I promise. I just want to say that I, you know, bringing it back to the main lady of the night, which is our awesome, wonderful babe, Yoko Ono, I noticed some comments on the Facebook, and there were some people who had some negative things to say about Yoko and had some negative things to say about her art and her music, and, you know, we're all entitled to our opinions. I think it would be wonderful to leave things off on this note. We are not here to change your mind, okay? So if you have already made up your mind about an artist, if you've already made up your mind about Yoko Ono, then, you know, okay. Congratulations. And we are not going to try to persuade you to feel differently. And I felt like I wanted to say something about this because I noticed the comments and I didn't respond because, you know, what am I going to say if you already think that she is this or that, then
well,
that's up to you.
Okay? Honestly, I think that's like, that is an important thing to bring up. I would say like, we encourage you to disagree with us, but just do it in like in a way that facilitates conversation. Like if there's something about, this episode that you found particularly interesting or compelling or that you maybe disagree with, write us an email. A not rude email, of course. Write us an email and be like, hey, I think this about this, and we would love to keep
yeah.
the conversation going. That's
and, yeah.
totally doable.
Say, like, here's why, and this is why I think this way, and I think that we could have a meaningful conversation, but
yeah, so if you have...
at the end of the day, we're just some gals talking about art
yeah.
and hanging out.
Exactly. So, I mean, we just... I think the entire goal of this podcast is to open up conversation about taboo topics or interesting topics. So, yeah, if you do have any thoughts or questions, email us at arthistorybabes@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter at arthistorybabes. You can find us on Instagram at arthistorybabespodcast. Check out our website, arthistorybabes.com. It's got everything on it. But thank you so much for listening. You all are so great and so awesome, and we're so excited to have you listening to us talk about art. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Have a good time.
From Cabernet to Monet, they're here to slay the art history babes.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.